Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to another one of our Urbanite Conversations. Cheryl Cashin is the person you'll see in the front of the Urbanite magazine this month as the our Q&A. She's professor of law at Georgetown University. She teaches constitutional law and race and American law, among many other things. She's written a new book called The Agitator's Daughter, a memoir of four generations of one extraordinary African-American family. She's written a book called Failures of Integration, which was an editor's choice in the New York Times Book Review. And a nominee for the 2005 Hurston Wright Legacy Award for nonfiction. She worked in the Clinton White House as an advisor on urban and economic policy. And she's done many things. She's clerked for one of my favorite justices, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall and Judge Abner Mikva, among others. And I could go on talking all about her, but then we wouldn't have the conversation. Cheryl, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
So one of the themes in this month's magazine is race and separation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really you examined it probably more thoroughly than most in your book, The Failures of Integration. And we, I think, in some ways talk always about why do black folks sit separately and why are we so separate and why do black people live in Prince George's County and white people live in Montgomery County. But the more interesting stuff is what you began to tackle, which is why that happened and why there was this failure of integration once we broke the back of segregation. Talk about where you see the root of that.
Right. I want to underscore, despite the happy title of my book, The Failures of Integration, that we did have a chief victory with the civil rights movement, which is that in opinion polls, the vast majority of Americans will say that they believe America should be an integrated society and that they would prefer to live in an integrated neighborhood and that they think of America as a place where no one should be limited in their access to anything based on race. And that's a wonderful victory. So most people would prefer to live in a diverse environment. But what I talk about in the book is that where we're falling down is our public policies actually are premised on the idea that people should be separated based on race and class. No, you're right. We no longer have de jure segregation where the state mandated that the races be separate. But so many of our major public policies steer us in a segregated direction. And the individual who enters the housing market looking for that ideal integrated stable neighborhood with good schools doesn't realize that the public policies are set against him or her, even though that you know they might prefer that. And you know, I'll just tick off. I don't want to bore your.
No, you will not.
But there are four main public policies. One, local zoning. America has more local governments than most westernized nations because we've bought this religion of, you know, the local power that the best place, and it's sort of like a Jefferson or, you know, Tocquevillian idea, the ideal of, you know, democracy should occur at the lowest level, the closest to the city. And so we have in any given state, you know, a proliferation of all these local towns, and each of them have the zoning power, and it fosters this parochialism where it fosters this idea that we have to zone so that we create the best tax base possible so we won't have apartments, just garden variety, affordable apartments in our town because that doesn't give us high property values. So that's one policy. Another is historic policies where basically the federal government taught banks and the lending industry to be fearful of race mixing, be fearful of neighborhoods where there's the class is mixed. So, you know, investment in housing tends to be skewed toward segregated areas. And I could go on and on. So it's a failure of public policy. Despite our beautiful American values where we profess to believe in integration, our public policies don't reflect that vision.
So when we talk about, when people talk about this as a failure of public policy, when people talk about, as in the lawsuits that took place in Baltimore around public housing that were intentionally segregated.
Right.
Those kinds of things.
Right.
But how does those very serious public policy questions feed into the reality that some people say in a heterogeneous nation like ours, that separation is natural. That people do not come together naturally. That African Americans create, in some ways, their own suburbs, whether it's Baltimore County or Prince George's County. That white folks, as you're talking about, decide, well, okay, I'm not doing this because I don't want to be near black people or Latinos, but really I want a better school system and a quieter place to live. And
right. You know, there is this thing of preferences. You know, there's a dissonance between what we say about liking diversity and what we actually choose. Now, like I said, it's sort of a chicken and egg problem. There's more demand for stable, integrated neighborhoods than there are neighborhoods to fill that demand. If you're a black person living in the Washington, D.C., Baltimore area, and you have, you know, the economic wherewithal and, you know, the credit score to get a mortgage, which is, you know, difficult in these times.
At best.
If you actually have the economic power to have real choice, the market doesn't give you a lot of options. Either you can choose to live in a neighborhood where blacks are few, or you can choose to live in a neighborhood where blacks are a majority, if not an overwhelming majority. There's not a lot of in-between. And I argue in my book that it's public policies that create that stark choice. And it's not surprising. Human nature is such that if my choice is between a neighborhood where I'm going to be vastly outnumbered by different people who may or may not feel positive toward me, it's not surprising that a lot of African Americans might choose to live in a neighborhood where their own group is in a majority. And in all public, you know, social science surveys where people are given a choice of a range of neighborhoods, the majority of all the races tend to choose neighborhoods where their own group is in a majority or plurality. That's human nature. But public policy doesn't have to make it doesn't have to be premised on the idea that people should be separated. Public policy doesn't, you know, I mean, I think Baltimore, if I'm correct, I think Baltimore recently adopted an inclusionary zoning ordinance.
Yes, it did.
I may be wrong about that, but
no, you're
some,
right. Yes, it did.
Okay, right. Okay, some places like Montgomery County have had public policies on the books for 30 years in which they require what they call inclusionary zoning. They require any new residential development, a certain percentage, about 10 to 15% of the units, be affordable units. And that county, because of that public policy, is much stabler. It's a very diverse county, and it doesn't have intense pockets of concentrated minority poverty. It doesn't have ghettos. It doesn't have barrios, because they've chosen to have public policies that foster inclusion. So they're doing a lot better than a lot of other places with managing diversity in a way where there's more opportunity in the housing market and there's more opportunity to find good schools that happen to be both diverse and good. And that's all I'm saying. Yes, they're personal preferences, but our policies don't have to play to our worst fears.
But you talk in the book a lot about class and how class plays into this.
Right.
And a couple of things with that. I mean, one, Montgomery County has poverty and has people who are not wealthy, but is a middle-class, upper-middle-class county in large part. It's one of the wealthiest counties in the nation.
Absolutely.
Now, in Baltimore, you write about MTO, the move to opportunity, at the end of your book, and when you talk about what can be done. Well, when they tried MTO in Baltimore, again, about 10 years ago or so, a congressman, Bob Ehrlich, who later became governor, led the fight in Baltimore County to say no to MTO and really raised the kind of, in many ways, racist populist anger about MTO and stopped it. So, and when you think of Montgomery County, I think, well, if really it was going to integrate, then somehow there'd be a tie to Washington, D.C., or for Baltimore, there'd be a tie going across boundaries, and you called it, talk about regionalism at the end of your book as well. I mean, so how does public policy change this behavior without being onerous and authoritarian?
Right. Well, the best scenario for us to move in places like Baltimore County to more inclusive policies is for multiracial coalitions to be built to fight for saner public policies. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that a church-based multiracial coalition advocated for the inclusionary zoning ordinance that Baltimore adopted.
Right.
And what I say in my book is, you know, we have a real conundrum, and this is not just in Baltimore, but throughout the United States. In the 21st century, America is going to move, whether you're ready for it or not, from being a majority white country to a majority multiracial country. And there are already four states that are there. California, Hawaii, Texas, and New Mexico are already majority minority, and about 100 U.S. cities are there. And so whether you like it or not, if you're, you know, the average American lives in a metropolitan region, increasingly you are not going to be able to avoid diversity. And so how do we make that transition in a way which in which opportunity is going to be broadly available to the masses? And we can either continue the way of the bulwark and try to be fragmented, and you know, people can try to buy their way into an exclusive neighborhood where they can avoid, you know, class issues. They can avoid that Section 8, you know, lower income person. But as we know with this economy, there's only going to be a very small segment of the society that will be able to afford to do that. What I've argued, my view is that we have a war of visions in this country about how to respond to rapidly accelerating diversity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm encouraged by the sort of optimistic multiracial coalitions that are beginning to form in places like Baltimore. It was evident in the 2008 election with Barack Obama. It was an optimistic, multiracial coalition that reached 53%, where people were voting on their hopes and their aspirations rather than their fears. And wherever you see saner, inclusive policies, fair share affordable housing, inclusionary zoning happening, being adopted, it's coming as a result of multiracial coalitions that are educating people about how it's actually in your rational self-interest to pursue policies in which we have stabler neighborhoods where a majority of the people in the neighborhoods are middle class. You know, no neighborhood should be overrun by poverty. You know, the problem with affordable housing policies is that people, you know, when they hear affordable housing, they think, oh, you know, those awful public housings,
right.
You know, I don't want the ghetto coming to my neighborhood. So the knee-jerk reaction is to, you know, fight that. But if we educate people through grassroots organizing, particularly church-based organizing, which is happening in a lot of places, I think we get saner public policies that give people more choice.
So if there is this divide in America, and that part of what drives the fear of some people to live together is race. I mean, there is racism, I mean to say. I mean, people don't want to talk about it very loudly sometimes, but, you know, part of a reaction to Barack Obama can be policy driven, or it can be driven by policy plus the fear of a majority non-white America in the next 50 years. And
it's actually going to be less than 50 years. 2042 is the year that demographers predict we will be a majority minority nation. So, you know,
but
it's actually 32 years, not too far away.
That's not too far away. I may
still... And it's already here. Like I said, it's already here in 100 U.S. cities. It's already here in California. So,
but because the nation will be majority non-white, does it mean that we'd have integration, that we'd have an integrated society?
No, it doesn't mean that. What I'm saying, you know, I said it in this book, The Failures of Integration. I'm thinking about writing another book about this, is that demographics are rapidly changing this country, and they're going to change no matter what. those changes are inevitable. Change is inevitable. And the question is, how does America respond to those changes and harness them, hopefully in a positive way? And I think we can pursue an optimistic ethos of inclusion, or we can pursue a kind of guarded separatism that's based upon negative stereotypes and our fears about difference. And, you know, if you think about it, what America is going to look like virtually everywhere in 2042, if the majority of the workforce is going to be black, brown, yellow, or much of it is, America's not going to be able to be competitive if you haven't built a society where the vast majority of Americans are able to get an excellent education and good skills and, you know, and be cultivated as citizens who feel like they have a stake in this society. I think we have no choice but to go the way of inclusion rather than the way of the bulwark. And I'm actually optimistic about our ability to do that. You know, there's a lot of positive things going on in this country. You can see it in media, you know. I mean, you see these things like, I don't want to be too simplistic or flippant about this, because yes, there are a lot of very difficult, divisive issues, but increasingly in media, you'll see images of interracial couples. I mean, mainstream organizations and companies, Banana Republic, you know, featuring the black girl and the white guy, you know, in an intimate pose. And I think there is this ethos of excitement about diversity. But you know, the average citizen trying to make good choices from their family can be bewildered by all this. And but I think, and I'll point to the example of BUILD. It's the multiracial organization that brought about this inclusionary zoning in Baltimore.
In Baltimore, yeah.
It's a Baltimore Regional Initiative. I'm sorry, Bridge. Baltimore Regional Initiative Developing Genuine Equality, Bridge. You know, it's a church-based organization that works across denominational, racial, geographic, and socioeconomic boundaries. But basically, there is a grassroots movement. You might think about it as the civil rights movement of the 21st century. There are church-based regional organizations that have been working in metropolitan America, metropolitan regions for a decade or so now, that are building these relationships across these artificial boundaries of race and class and getting to saner policies. For the individual who's listening to me, who's excited by diversity, wants more of it, but wants to see it managed in a way where they don't feel like they have to sacrifice their children, you know, to bad schools or those kinds of things, but wants to educate themselves. What can I do as an individual to bring about this inclusive society? Well, you can join organizations like Bridge. There's a website, there's a national organization called the Gamaliel Foundation. Actually, the two organizations in American society who are doing the best job at this the Gamaliel Foundation. It's Gamaliel, a biblical word. Mm-hmm. And they have affiliates in about 50 cities, and they basically teach grassroots, mass-based organizing, the kind of stuff that happened in the civil rights movement, where organizations come together to pursue more sane public policies that get us to more inclusion. The other organization is the Industrial Areas Foundation, and there's a Industrial Areas affiliate in Baltimore called BUILD.
BUILD, right.
Right. And so if you're a citizen who wants to know more about this and know how to pursue this optimistic, inclusive vision I'm talking about, you can join. Go to the websites of these organizations and get involved. Diversity is a dynamic project in process. And, you know, my hope is that I believe in the goodwill of Americans of all races. I really do. I believe that most people are goodwilled. Most people are not racist in their consciousness, in their conscious thinking. They're open to difference, but you know there is a lot of studies about our subconscious. All of us walk around with these sort of subconscious negative stereotypes about people who look this way are more likely to be associated with crime or whatever.
Right.
You know, all of us have our implicit biases and our subconscious fears, but you know. If we do nothing, I think we will get separation if we do nothing.
So let me take three or four specifics here that come out of your books in some ways. What do you think the policies are or the approaches would be to make Northern Virginia more integrated, make Prince George's County more integrated, both on a human level and others as well. How does that? You write in the book. There's this great chapter in the book about all the intentionally and interracial cities and neighborhoods in this country, that have thrived, but they are less common.
The minority. Only about 5 to 10% of American neighborhoods are stably integrated.
Exactly. I lived in one for 25 years, which is a place
called. Which one did you live in?
Windsor Hills. Which is on the west side of Baltimore City, right by the Leakin Park, which is the largest deciduous forest in urban America, or the second largest. Mm-hmm. And it used to be an old Jewish neighborhood. Then it became an integrated neighborhood, and gay couples began to move in as well. And it remained majority African American, but interracial.
And that's a very common story. I live in Shepherd Park in Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
It's a similar story. A number of neighborhoods in the 50s that were majority Jewish affirmatively decided when blacks, with the wave of the civil rights movement and changes in housing laws, that when blacks started moving in, that they were going to consciously try to be inclusive and remain integrated rather than and fight blockbusting. And there are a number of examples of neighborhoods like that, which I talk about in my book, West Mount Airy, Philadelphia,
right.
Shaker Heights, Ohio. So there, it took an intentionality to create that environment. So you ask what specific public
yep.
policies might get us to more integration. Well, number one, inclusionary zoning, a policy which says explicitly that any new development above a certain size has to have low-income or moderate-income units. That's a public policy choice. Increasingly, these are less controversial because it's average middle-class white folks who are often priced out of the priced out of housing. And in areas where you have a multiracial coalition that's going to citizen groups and doing the labor-intensive work of educating people about what this means, about it's not something to be feared, it's something to be embraced because it's going to give you more choice and it's going to avoid the ghetto problem. You know, almost every area, including areas in Northern Virginia, have had influxes of immigrants, of minorities, and some low-income people. You're less likely to have problems with gangs and problems that are associated with high concentrated poverty if you pursue moderate levels of inclusion. Like I said, the ideal is for every neighborhood to have a dominant middle class norm. You know, exposing low income people to middle class norms is one of the ways that you have upward mobility, so that low income people can see other people going to work and see what middle class behavior looks like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you isolate low income people to neighborhoods where only other low income people live, you get a lot of behavior that is aberrant. And I don't have any problem saying that. So one thing is inclusionary zoning policies. Another which I write about, is MTO, housing mobility programs, which give people vouchers and the ability to try to find to live in a variety of areas. Now, of course, if localities aren't building moderate priced apartments, you know, it's going to be hard for MTO to work. But again, it would take a multiracial grassroots coalition, regional coalition that's educating communities about the sanity of these policies for these things to be less controversial and be adopted.
But
I also talk about universal school choice. So many school districts have moved back to neighborhood assignment plans. There are some places that have experimented with proposals that decouple where you live from where you get to go to school and allow people to admit, you know, have some choices, you know, up to three choices about schools that they might have access to. And they can be designed different ways, but choice-based programs that allow people to possibly go to schools in another district. And there are some places like the Boston suburbs that have programs like this where they voluntarily accept, you know, a percentage, 10%, you know, of students from other school districts, things like that. I could give you a laundry list of public policies that
right.
might help, but it's what we need more of is an activist, is the grassroots coalition building to get us to a place where a majority of Americans support policies like this.
So if you take just some of the things you just said, if you take the idea, let's just take two of them, universalizing school districts, in a sense,
mm-hmm.
And MTO. Now, when MTO was created, the backlash against MTO has been severe in this country. That the idea of poor people using vouchers to move into the suburbs has created a very serious populist, angry opposition. I mean, A. And B, that the question of allowing universal access to education, I mean, you know, as long as we have these property taxes in our society, let's say in Maryland, that are all based on localities, then it's going to be hard to make – unless you could change that to a statewide property tax, it's hard to begin to change that consciousness because that little things like that make a huge difference in that – I mean, the idea – I'm just trying to – I can hear the struggle now if you're going to say to Baltimore County and Anne Arundel County and Howard County around Baltimore City or to Prince George's County and Montgomery County in Washington, D.C., we're going to open school choice so any student can go to any school they choose.
Well, I wouldn't – no policy like that would work. I mean, you have to design these things in a way where you're mediating between you give people some choice, but no guarantees. So I just want to make it clear. When I advocate universal school choice, I'm not advocating that. That just wouldn't work because everybody would choose, you know, the number one schools in the state, and that school would be overrun, right? So you would have to design these things. Well, like, for example, I believe it's Cambridge, but there. A number of school districts, about two dozen school districts, have adopted these choice policies. You could call them, I think they're called like controlled choice policies, where they give parents three choices and say, give us your number one, number two, and number three choice, and we will try to give you one of your top three choices in assignment. But our overall public policy goal is that no school will have more than 50% of their kids on free and reduced lunch. That's our public policy goal, because it is very hard to educate children in an environment where most of the kids are poor for a lot of reasons. And so they try, and they're doing better than places that don't try. I will not these are the hardest issues in American society.
Yep.
I don't pretend that these are easy issues, right? But what is the alternative? MTO, you're right. This is one of the most controversial policies because of the specter of fear.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that, you know, if I have some low-income person coming to my community, and let's be frank, and I'm very frank in my book, that whenever you talk about affordable housing, the fear factor is non-blacks' fear of blacks, you know, and what comes to people's mind, they may not talk about it, but comes to people's mind is, you know, some ghetto-acting black person coming to my neighborhood, and the response is, H-E-L-L, no. You know, I'm a mother of twins, and I spell bad words. You know, and the fascinating thing about these Gamaliel affiliates is they take these issues head on. They don't hide the ball. They confront these issues head on. And in their conversations with groups, and typically they find and they build relationships with suburban churches because, you know, people who are serious about their faith are the most likely people in American society to be open to reevaluating their fears and open to take, you know, seriously the Christian message about we're all God's children, right? And despite the challenges that you identify in terms of this backlash to MTO, there are communities that have succeeded. Just a year ago in New Jersey, the Gamaliel affiliate succeeded in getting a piece of legislation passed in New Jersey. In the shorthand explanation of it is, now because of this law, every single locality in New Jersey has to have its fair share of affordable housing. And that is a revolutionary concept. And the way they did it was they did the labor-intensive work of building these coalitions between potentially strange bedfellows, but working a lot through church-based organizations. And they built a coalition that got to 51% in the state legislature. And that's what my main argument is. You don't have to convince everybody. There are always going to be people who can't get beyond their fears about race, can't get beyond their fears about difference, can't get beyond their fears about low-income black people, right? You don't have to convince everybody. You only have to get to 51% in whatever policy forum you're dealing with. And the Gamaliel affiliates, they are organizing in a way where they can send out an email and say, we need at least 2,000 people tomorrow to show up at this hearing. And thousands of people do because they are passionate about this stuff and they're doing the work. You know, whatever your political or ideological orientation is, what you can see in American politics is that the groups that do the grassroots organizing are the ones that win elections and set the direction in public policy. And all I'm trying to convert people to this optimistic vision about inclusion, and I know that there will be people who oppose me, but I have confidence that a majority of Americans will come to this vision because we have no other options.
So, I mean, and you really are talking about political organizing. I mean, your stories about Wake County and Charlotte-Mecklenburg in North Carolina, I just found really interesting just because of where it is and what happened in Montclair High School. These things can happen, but it takes what you call a coalition, but it's a political struggle it takes. It takes an organization of people who are willing to fight for something, which is really, in some ways, what we've forgotten how to do.
Right, right. You know, and I've in my writing and thinking had just been, I spent a lot of time studying the civil rights movement.
Well, you were born in it.
Huh?
You were born in it.
I was born in Peru. My mother took me to a sit-in when I was 4 months old and got herself arrested with me in her arms. You know, that's how committed my family were. My family was to this idea of inclusion. You know, absolutely. But the civil rights movement transformed this country seemingly overnight. You know, we went from a country where 80% of the people in surveys would say openly that I would move if a black person lived into my neighborhood, to where a vast majority of people say the opposite. No, I wouldn't move. In fact, I might be happy that there's some diversity coming to my neighborhood. That was a radical social transformation, and it happened seemingly overnight. But if you go back and study the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King's organization. Why is it eluding me?
The which one? What's
Martin Luther King's organization? The name is eluding me.
Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
Yeah, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. They with the Leander Folk School. They taught local people how to organize, how to engage in this mass nonviolent protest. You know, and it's not an accident that you had people doing sit-in movements, sit-in protests in over 100 cities, because that they did the work of teaching people how to engage in this movement, right? It's labor-intensive, right? I don't deny that.
So I'm curious, just going back to your world and your life,
mm-hmm.
When you write in another book about your great-grandfather, Herschel mm-hmm. Cashin.
Right.
Who came back to Alabama during Reconstruction. I mean,
right.
The roots of the struggle go back to Herschel Cashin.
In my own personal family, yes.
I mean,
yes.
In the country, I think, in some ways. He's symbolic
yes.
of
I mean,
that, emblematic of that.
Absolutely. You know, the most transformative changes in this country, abolition of slavery, Reconstruction, the civil rights movement, they were all the result of biracial coalition. I say biracial because the population was mainly black, all overwhelmingly white with a small black minority, but they were biracial coalitions in which black people, people of color, played a meaningful role. And in this book I wrote, The Agitator's Daughter, I wrote this book trying to understand the source of my parents' passions, why they would put so much on the line. You know, I mean, think about it. How many women would take a baby 4 months old to a civil rights protest? Not many, right? And I found, I had this family lore that came from my great-grandfather, but my great-grandfather was educated at a school in Philadelphia in which the head of the boys' department was an agitator, who was leading civil rights protests in the 1870s in Philadelphia, voting rights leagues. There has been a small group of agitators and strugglers from the founding of this nation who wanted to make the ideals of our Declaration of Independence true for everybody. But it's a vision that's had to be fought for, and I think America is doing better with race relations than a lot of other places, and ultimately will do better because we've had this history of grassroots civil rights protests and movements in which people do the hard work of fighting for a more inclusive vision.
We've even seen it internationally. I mean, when you saw the 100,000 people in Copenhagen from every country in the world crossing every racial line on the planet, fighting mm-hmm. for a planet that we can all live on. But it was the most
right.
that was an amazing. The mainstream media didn't cover very much the magnificence of this multiracial international movement in the streets of Copenhagen during that conference. That was amazing.
Yes, and I want to go online to see that picture. But we've seen that picture increasingly. We've seen that picture. I don't want to politicize this too much, but you saw that picture a lot during the 2008 election, when Barack Obama would speak, inevitably, he was speaking to extraordinarily diverse audiences.
Yes.
And that's what our world looks like. And the people who prevail in terms of what public policies will be in the 21st century are going to be the people and the political parties that speak to a broad range of people. You know, if you are only speaking to your own identity group or your own single issue group, ultimately you're not likely to be very successful. And that's the beauty of diversity. You know, you are not going to have any choice increasingly but to learn the skills of speaking across boundaries of difference, you know, be it in the corporate sector or, you know, in schools, in the public, whatever. If you don't learn that language, if you don't learn to be what I call culturally dexterous, you know, if you don't develop cultural dexterity, what do I mean by that? The ability to walk in a room and potentially be completely outnumbered by a different group and experience that not with flight, you know, a fright response for, oh, I got to get out of here, but hey, this is cool, I can hang, you know. It's the people who are culturally dexterous who are going to be successful in this century.
So would you consider yourself, Cheryl Cashin, as you look at the rest of the world here, you are optimistic about where we can take America, or is your vision more dystopian about where we're going?
Well, you know, I would be lying if I didn't say I have moments of despair. I would be lying if I didn't say that I could write a book that's very negative and just focuses on the things that are wrong about the United States. But, you know, I go back often to King. You know, you go when I'm down, I'll read that letter from a Birmingham jail, mm-hmm. you know, which is profound. And if Martin Luther King had accepted the pessimism of some of his critics, even critics within his own camp, he never would have written that letter, and he never would have believed in a vision that some people couldn't see it. You know, it was only around the corner, but the America we have today, there's so many people who can see it. The same way, like, so many people, black people included, they just could not conceive of a black man being president of the United States. It was beyond their imagination, right? And if you give in to cynicism or your fears or your, you know, pessimism, there's so much that you could be missing. I choose to be optimistic. I dare to be optimistic because I see glimpses of this beautiful ethos that could be, you know, and I definitely saw glimpses of it in the Obama campaign, you know, the power of diversity when it's harnessed as a positive thing. I will get up every day and fight for that vision. You know, hopefully on days when my twin 3-year-olds haven't worn me out. But there's so much that's good about this country, and it's also just a more joyful place to be. And working for something you believe in with like-minded fellows is also a joyful way to live. And that's part of what I celebrated in my family memoir, The Agitator's Daughter, that, you know, there's always going to be struggle. You know, things could always be better than they are. And there is value and meaning in living a life in which you spend much of your waking hours fighting for what you believe in, even when there are going to be days when, you know, you fall down or your group falls down and doesn't get what it hopes for.
So even when I think about Agitator's Daughter now, and not the failures of integration, but how they mm-hmm. connect in some ways, because your call for a social and political movement that really begins to change things in America and coalitions that have to be formed, and you come out of a legacy that I think you yourself said that it took time for you to get over, because the struggle to integrate American and segregation almost crushed your father, Dr. John Cashin, who was a dentist and lost everything.
Right. You know, my father founded an independent political party in Alabama, the National Democratic Party of Alabama, at a time when the Alabama Democratic Party was dominated by George Wallace and was committed. Its official party slogan was white supremacy for the white. So he was officially committed to white supremacy as late as 1967. And my father founded this party and poured hundreds of thousands of dollars of his own money into this party. He was a dentist, right? He put everything on the line. And by the time I was 18, he was broke. You know, the city of Huntsville had taken his dental office by eminent domain. The airplane that he piloted, he had his own plane, very flamboyant guy, you know, was sabotaged twice and he crashed in it. It's a miracle that he's still alive today. But, you know, I did question him putting everything on the line. But as I wrote the book, it's like my own private therapy, right? I wrote the book to understand his choices. And as a parent today, I wouldn't go to the extremes that he went to, but I honor his passions. You know, he may not have done everything right in terms of, you know, protecting his family, but I honor his passions, and I think it's the best way to live. You know, to have a life where you're committed to something larger than yourself. You know, committed to more than just accumulating money and things, right? I honor that.
But I mean, but he lived at a time when there was a desperate struggle to end segregation. I mean, it was a pitched battle.
Right.
And you may do that if the pitched battle arrived again.
Well,
any of us might.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I would ever go to the extremes that my father did. You know, my dad was a bit of a crazy man.
He sounds wonderful.
You know, he said there's a line in that book where it says every movement needs an SOB. I'm spelling it. I was in the SOB. That's, you know, I'm a little more cautious. It's probably because I went a little bit to the you know, self-preservation mode of, you know, I'm a writer, not really an activist. but you know, I do honor and hope to be the kind of person that will stand up for her ideals even when it's inconvenient, you know, even when it might bring social opprobrium to me, or even, you know, that is what I hope to be. I don't know that I live up to it all the time.
But
you know,
one of the things you end this book, the failures of integration, with your sense that we need to find, that America can find, that unity we found on 9/11 that crossed all racial lines and class lines.
I hope so. I really do. You know, that was a beautiful, it was a terrible moment because of what had happened. Except for the poor people who were perceived as Muslims, even when they might not have been.
Right.
You know, there was a lot of ugliness in the same moment, but there was also this moment of cohesion, of social cohesion. You know, of people rethinking and celebrating what America was and what America stands for. And I really hope that we will, over time, cultivate that idea of, you know, America was founded on the idea of freedom. And, you know, I hope we'll get there in terms of being truly a place where nobody, including Muslims, you know, I'm starting to write about this, you know, nobody is excluded or feared just because of the way they look, or they're you know, they have a different religion, or, you know, that's going to take work and education.
Well, there are at least as many Muslims as there are Jews in America, more Muslims than there are Episcopalians. So
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Thank you for sharing that.
It's true. And it's a growing religion in America. Cheryl Cashin, this has been just a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much. I'm flattered and honored to have been asked.
It's been wonderful. We look forward to talking to you again, and we will do that.